Good morning. Congress, honorable members, gentlemen and ladies. I suppose we all have copies of today's program. In case you do not have it, please do indicate. Staff will make one available to you. I want to welcome the Director General of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, and also the DG of Trade and Industry. Welcome. I also want to welcome the staff from the AG's office, but to particularly and specifically welcome the Deputy Auditor General, Mr. Kimi Makwetu. Welcome. Right, as our program states, we will start with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. As always, let's start with the introductions. I think we'll do them once. So, after justice, maybe trade industry, you could also know who is here. National Treasury, yes. National Treasury, yes, let's also know who is here. Today we're around. And then the AG's office will introduce themselves, then members, and then we can then start the talk for me. Over to you, Advocate.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable members of the committee and colleagues. We do welcome the opportunity to come back here again. With me is the CFO, Ms. Sandra Gong, who's for today's here.
Thank you. As the DG said, we welcome this opportunity to be back here. We have, in our previous interaction with the committee, discussed this matter, and we're happy that we can finalize it here today.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Trade and industry.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I have with me a team that consists of department staff, and because we're also going to deal with CITRO, I've got the CEO of CITRO here, with Keith Sandwich, and he's accompanied by the CFO of CITRO.
Where are they?
The CFO of CITRO is with Renier Chitot. And as of DTI, I have the CFO of the DTI, Kumara Naidu, as well as the Director of Procurement of the DTI, Mr. Dion Tommy. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Consider.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Henry Malinda. I am responsible for supply chain policy and government. With me, I have colleagues from the national treasury that are responsible for this particular portfolio.
My name is Randall Randella, National Treasury, Public Finance. Lolo.
I see. Chair, good morning. My name is Corey Sicilius. I'm a senior manager of the Auditor General, and I'm here for the performance audit report on DTI.
Good morning, Chief Hickman. I'm Andy
Feldman.
I'm the Auditor General, Senior Manager, responsible for investigation and justice.
Thank you very much. Carl, we welcome and introduce you. It's not necessary for you to do so. You are happy, welcome. But you are leading the troop, but understand you're leading from behind. Welcome, nonetheless. The matter we get to discuss with yourself, are based on the report of the Auditor General on investigation into procurement in the department. Well, unlike the last time when we met, we were dealing with the annual report in its project plan. But there, I think we are looking at a much, much focused area. I see that in a matter of weeks we'll be having your final report again. Not only that, we have for that an opportunity to meet again. And then we can talk about matters very, very broad. But for today we go into the focus. Well, I will hand over to comment number one to kickstart the process. Yes, Comrade.
Thank you very much, Captain.
Just pull it towards yourself. Yes.
Thank you very much, Captain. After the Auditor General's report, the procurement process is not timely and effectively done. So what we want to know firstly is what causes these weaknesses. Secondly, what mechanisms have been put in place in order to ensure that new service providers and appointed effectively and timely in line with the relevant legislation. That's my first question.
We requested this audit simply because the CFO and I picked up that the major rules of the area of supply chain management that we want to make sure are in order. Because when we get the documents during the process, we noted that they clearly appear to be part of the process that when 2036 is 2 months moving from the comments of the staff. So we thought that let's get a full picture of specifically this transaction because it involves a lot of service providers. What really was the issue? To give a bit of background,
If I got the question well, your concern is that so maybe can you repeat the question? Because I don't somehow I think that instead of going wide, let's keep it now. Just repeat the question.
Okay, the principle that I need to know is that what were the weaknesses of the staff for not doing what they're supposed to be doing, how they're supposed to be doing it, and also what mechanism have you put in place in order to rectify. So this is the last time we asked the purpose of this.
Thank you, Chair. I thought the background would help you understand why it happened in this role, because it was trivial to work down like this. And that also occasioned part of the challenge. But I'll tell you that and get to the point. There's a number of weaknesses which still exist today. Part of those weaknesses is understanding of supply chain management generally across the board. Not all officials understand supply chain management very well. It's a new process that everyone is trying to grapple with, which is different from previous standard processes. So with that, there are a few things that we're spending time on, including training of officials. But we're spending time as well on effective planning, because before you go on these standard processes, you want to prepare based on the strategies up front. How are you going to do certain things? So part of the process here at the location, some of the difficulties is that the process wasn't fully mapped out with respect to these services, because we were also looking at changing the whole environment. These are subscription services where we take the records from court, and we're using, as you know, for the first purposes, an old system. We were changing that system. We were changing it completely, which was done and successfully done in that event. But a transcription service is a separate one. So in planning, officials have challenges because the current system that is used to record also offers in itself a transcription service, which wasn't part of the original source. But when engaged with the service provider that provided, it became very clear that system is capable of delivering the transcription service. So we have to then...
So in short, the issue here is it's lack of planning, proper planning.
It's a contributory factor, but it's also infected upon by what's available coming from the market as part of the change.
I think the point here is that you had a contract that was expired. And instead of preparing, your contract expires in October.
Yeah.
But come October, you have not, within reasonable time, made the arrangement for that when it expires. You already have started the
I think
let's hold it at that. Now, the second part of the question is, what measure, since we went through that experience, and since this report came out, what measures are in place to ensure that we don't have a reputation that when the current service provider contract ends, you don't have this kind of situation repeating itself?
What we've done is that we've always reviewed all the contracts that we have, 77 agreements. So that we can start processes way beforehand. And have new service providers where we need them appointed before the end of term of the current one. That's one thing that we have done. With respect to these ones in particular, we looked at it, but we may not go this route again going forward because it's going to be an unnecessary element of our work because of the modernization that we've done. This service won't be offered in the future in the way that it is.
Do you have something? Okay.
Thank you. Before she adds something, can I also find out, has there been any disciplinary processes done in regards to those who have defaulted?
Well, that I would give you in detail, but it's started on the
thank you, Chief.
Can we speak on that one? Yes, it's not a process against the official who did not do their work in terms of planning or in relation to what?
All of the responsibilities fall within certain job descriptions of various individuals. And it's not just the core that could have done bid evaluation. It also includes the core that could have prepared and needed to prepare a price according to what they have put in place. So, for example, it could include people that are responsible for managing the contracts that ended. Because it's the same people that could have informed the kickstarting of the new process, which they didn't. So those officials currently explaining, you know, how they're okay and why they should have participated for doing that aspect of the work properly. Then once we've done this, we get to the evaluation processes and we get to the supply chain management processes. Those are right. Other than
okay. Let's not go that far. Let's take this in a third part. Can we be given that information, information in terms of those individuals and the processes that are taking place against them? That's part. Yes, can you make your question?
Thank you, Jefferson. I think what is, to answer the question in very general sense, the problem that we really face with is that we come from a traditional procurement environment and we need to now implement the supply chain management, integrated supply chain management policies of government. Now, all of that really came to the performance in 2004, 2005. So it's all about taking those traditional procurement people and bringing them over to understand supply chain management. If I say understand supply chain management, I say we need to consider the elements. And demand management, which is really about our planning, is a new concept for those procurement people. So we have established our organizational structure along those lines now of the supply chain management elements, and obviously we need to fill those folks now with the permanent people. We do have a vacancy in our supply chain management division, as I've mentioned in our previous scope of interaction, but we're working in getting those folks for. Thank you.
Yeah.
Chairperson, I don't think that was necessary because there's no way that you want to justify that you are moving from this side to that side, that is why you are having things only. Because you have to plan and properly ensure that you are successful. I am not saying there shouldn't be any weaknesses, but that is not justifiable. Can I move to the next question?
I seem to be getting a conflicting perspective. On the one hand, you are explaining you're explaining your predicament in terms of this new system, that it's a new system, so this problem, vacancies. But on the other hand, you are taking disciplinary measures against officials. How do you reconcile the two?
It's simply that some people, in fact, most of the people went through initial training to try and get them to understand the new system. Now, one cannot argue, therefore, that just because one has gone through training, one will not make errors. Because if you look at some of the mistakes, they are quite elementary in some respects. They're very elementary mistakes. And it's mistakes that could have been avoided. So from our perspective, you know, of the view that there is an element of fine continuous training so that people, you know, are skill-based in the hand, but also not allow an environment where basic errors shouldn't occur in the such that they should require higher level supervision. The things that we picked up that were confirmed by the Auditor General are things in my view that shouldn't require intervention and management. So if you look at it, I shouldn't be here explaining these types of things. So for me, that's a problem. Okay. So that's why you want to take action to ensure that things
are okay, my friend. Okay.
The next question is, does the federal regulation competitive have to be recorded and this principle has not been followed? Can you explain why?
That's not on the specifics. Again, it's not an indication of what is in our view about our regulation. Because in some respects, document management processes were done reasonably well. But in other parts of the processes, they were not done. And there can't be there's no explanation in our view why that wasn't done. So you do have officials giving their own perspectives about, you know, how busy they were, how they couldn't get around to doing it eventually. But again, it's that point that I'm making, that, you know, you're supposed to do everything from one part of the step to the end part of the step. So you can't do it where the first part is there, somewhere in the middle, you don't do it where you do it where the end. So it's a continuous change. So we do find that, you know, again, it's something that just shouldn't be taken care of easily. So document management process is a problem. We're not pleased to go to buy, just reiterating to the point that there is a point by point process that everybody should follow, that everybody should take off documents each and every aspect, which is now begun to be done.
Thank you very much. My next question is, the Auditor General report says five service providers were appointed as service providers, although they had not submitted required documents. The question is, what measures have been instituted to ensure that conditions of these documents are adhered to?
That is not submitted we did have cleaners that didn't submit all of the information in the manner that the steps required. Some documents were not there that should have been there in the format that we wanted. We also view again that if all of those non-strict compliance are picked up, there should be a process where every single step is documented so that whatever decision is taken, having considered a particular issue with respect to each bidder, it is pretty clear why a particular bid was taken by the people that were evaluating. So again, you know, you'd be asking a question because there isn't information taken for you that enables you to understand why the evaluation committee would have looked at issues in the way that they had. So for us, it's again document management and just ensuring that everything is written down on paper. So no matter how plausible an explanation can be, if it's not documented and written down, it's very difficult to appreciate. So again, we sought to just remind officials and insist that every single decision making step be documented and written for action taken, also written down.
Through the chairperson, are you saying that this question that you are asking today is the last time, because it will, in your next report, this won't appear again?
No, the lawyers are not exactly answering the question. It can never be that you can rule out anything at any point in time. So it doesn't matter what type of prosecution is, there's no proof of it, and there's no guarantee that no matter how well trained all officials will always perform to the extent and strict compliance. For me, it's a question of degree, degree of the extent of non-compliance, degree of the extent to which things may be done in a particular way. But to say that you never ask this question again, I'll never say. I think you will.
I think the point that the committee is trying to drive home is that once you have your policies in place and your procedure, the management monitoring and supervision come in. Meaning therefore that whatever weaknesses and shortcomings, non-compliance issues might be done at the lower level.
at least at management level should be able to pick them up before they bring it here. That's the point. So it might as well not be that none of your officials would not make a mistake, but that the level of management profession will decide that you are able to pick those things up and correct them before they come to this level. I think that is the context in which this is in the process.
To the extent that it's processes of that type, yes, it should be done. To the extent that even when that is done, but evaluation processes and document management is not done at that time, one would have to deal with it at that stage. But as a management enhancing tool, you know, you shouldn't be asking questions of this type on an ongoing basis. You know, there should be a significant improvement to show that the systems put in place are taking root and are having effect.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. The other question, can you please inform us whether the departmental de-justification committee declared their interest and were those declarations verified?
Previously, it wasn't part of the processes that they followed strictly, which they should have done. The only way now that we start to ensure that it's not repeated is that before they sit and adjudicate, they do actually sign and submit declarations for each bid, so we don't take a general. And those are kept with the state of order. As far as the clearances are concerned, we have engaged to the relevant institution, NIA in particular, to clear, to give us security clearances of our officials, including officials that work in this particular.
It's quite concerning. May I request that we switch our silver phones off? It's not giving silence, it affects the recording of the test. So, okay, please, switch it off.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My last question is, the Auditor's report indicates that four members of DBAC and DBEC did not attend the SCM training. My question is that why and what action has been taken if not the reasons are not justified?
We've concluded that there is no reason why they didn't attend the training when it was made available. So as part of the disciplinary process, the people that they didn't attend it. But there's nothing organic, and that they've all been trained and are going regular training. So we fixed it, but we will deal with it through the disciplinary process.
Thank you, comrade. Another good friend?
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick follow-up to my colleague. Can you give us the assurance that all the officials that have been negative in their duty, if I can put it in a nice way, that all of them are going to be investigated right across the board? Because in most of these questions, we could ask you whether you've taken disciplinary action or not. My honourable colleague did in one or two cases, but can you be assured that this is not just confined to certain areas, including the last question that the member asked, those that didn't attend, why didn't they attend? And then maybe you should just on that particular question, how many officials should have attended this?
The
recording
is
that you Yeah, but how many are they? How many is everyone? Now, actually, I want to come back to what we were told right up front, that, you know, that this has been a process of changing from an old system to a new system, and the people, you know, not familiar with it, and all the rest of it. But, you know, Chair, I have a huge problem. The PSM that I have in front of me is Act No. 1 of 1999.
And part of that entails that the cutting officer must ensure that an appropriate procurement and provisioning system which is fair, equitable, transparent, expedient, and cost effective is in place. That says that almost 8 years ago. Now, I just find it unacceptable to say that after 8 years, you know, you're still struggling to do this. And I don't know what to do about that, Chair, but I just want to make that point because I think we don't want to hear those sort of excuses. And then we hear that of the six people that should have got training, only four of them didn't even go to the training. Now, I think that's a serious disadvantage in duty. And if you want to go to the next page, it says here that the appropriate steps must be taken against these people, including criminal steps, if that's appropriate. But Chair, let's leave it at that because, you know, we so often say in this committee that we're trying to answer questions, but if we don't make examples of people, if we don't take action, then these things simply won't go away. They will just continue to haunt us forever and ever and ever. But Chair, I just wanted to make that because I think it's critically important, Chair. So let me get on to basically the area that I'm going to cover. And that is the payment side of it. Paragraph 5.1.8, the DG says, the Auditor General says, that you pay 35 to 38% on average more for the transcription service as a result of not awarding the contract to the service provider that obtained the highest number of points. Are you with me? Now, could we not, as a committee, could SOPA not regard that action as wasteful expenditure? Should we not regard that action as wasteful expenditure, which is in conflict with what the PSMA is saying? I'll repeat for you. You pay 35 to 38% more for a transcription service as a result of not awarding the contract to the service provider that obtained the highest number of points in terms of your own policy. Would you agree that that's wasteful expenditure?
I've never agreed.
You don't think it's wasteful expenditure?
No, I don't think so.
Well, maybe you should just tell us why not.
Yeah, I'll setup that we put in place, I'm not sure about other departments, that complies with the definition. In fact, let me say with the first suggestion that you're not going to make. The suggestion is made that since the putting in place of the PSMA, people don't go through training. People go through training on an ongoing basis. Any person that volunteers or makes themselves available to speak on the tender committee has to go through the training. That's the procedure that people do go through. Now, with these four in particular, at the time of their appointment, as is not picked up that they didn't go through it when they should have. Obviously, the same action as the one member correctly mentioned ought to be done with the incentive. Now, but it is not correct to suggest that since the promulgation of the PSMA, people don't go through training, there are no purposes that to go through.
Yes,
no,
this is, I think.
No, I'm dealing with the first one.
Yeah, I'm on that very first one. I think what the friend was saying was in the statement that the supply chain management is a new process and people are in the initial stages of the training, although training will continue, but it was a new process altogether. So what it's saying is that the act has been there for about 8 years, so it cannot be as new as to suggest that at the time of these incidents, people had just, you know, got into their jobs. So it was a new process altogether in the department. I think that's what it's saying. Not necessarily suggesting that you are saying that since the act was promulgated, there has been no training given to people. But the
study
in relation to supply chain management.
That's the point I'm not going to share, that the supply chain management is started in 2004, 2005 in government. It is new. The PSMA came much later than that. So supply chain management is a different process for procurement, is a relatively new thing. But tender procedures in general in government are as old,
point we're making is that when you follow a particular process that is in place, and that process gets enhanced or gets changed by introduction of another process, which in this case is supply chain management. To that extent, we have to bring the officials on board to understand these new changes, so that we don't really, as we have dealt with officials that still follow processes based on an old regime that already changed and no longer applicable. That is the issue that we're trying to explain here and there. What the president provides, as one of the members provides, which we agree with, but the supply chain management is in addition to what is in there, and it takes a different framework to deal with certain things. So to that extent, we have to take people through any new, like changes in tax legislation, any new changes, one has to be thinking that way. So, to that extent, we say it's new,
but we have to go through that. But then, TJ, I think in relation to this specific case, I think whilst it is new, I think maybe your emphasis should have been upfront that the substantive problems that people who were supposed to have been taken through training they did not attend the training. And then they then went on to do their work without having gone through that specific training. So out of six, only two went for that training and four did not attend that training. So I think it not contextualize it so that we don't deal with it at a general level. If those people have gone for training, then you who now they are choosing them of delivery and not compliance because they know what was supposed to be done, but they didn't avail themselves of that training process. But yeah, let's talk about that.
Yes, Chair, I want to see that, and I also want to say, Chair, that if I read this accurately, when the new system came into operation, in my view, I can ask the Minister of Finance question whether, in fact, this particular section of the Act was exempt from implementation. But can you remember that? It says here that you're responsible to have an effective system. Never mind what system it is, this system that you had at this time was not effective. Let's be honest. Therefore, I don't accept your explanation. But never mind. Let us go to something a little more specific. In paragraph 5.2.1, the Audit General says the following, and that's on page 7, I think. Yeah. It says that you were charged an amount higher than quoted by one supplier for the month of October. And then he said that overpayment was 1,163,000. And that was just on two batches that were inspected. Only two batches that overpayment took place. Now, once again, should this not be regarded as wasteful if you overpaid somebody? Well, let me start by saying, did you recover this money?
Every single one.
Every single one.
That was only two batches. Yeah. You were charged. I think in the exchanges we had, we actually proposed your initial question, which was why should we not consider a waste of expenditure, the fact that the department pays a higher amount than quoted by one supplier for the month of, I think, October 2005. So if we could just get these two questions dealt with there.
Yes, sir. And the second follow-up would be, if so, did you recover that money from?
No, we didn't. We didn't start the process to recover. We won't. The basis for paying the high amount is that there were certain aid and transfers that had to be done. And in terms of the agreement with the, in terms of this particular process, the code is for the normal process, but anything that is outside of the process, that agent, that actor, there's an additional fee that is added to the one standard. So that those payments were in respect of those agents, methods, etc. So we have to look at it, we have to look at it legally, whether or not it's fair and so forth. And our legal opinion is that it's a fair amount to pay, and it's reasonable under the circumstances.
Can you give us the assurance then, because that's only two batches that the Auditor General did, and the way I understand it, I think the Auditor General might like to say,
there were literally thousands and thousands of transactions. So, you know, even though the amount that you mentioned is a very small amount of money, it probably could be very material if you actually had to go into all of the contracts. I'm quite serious about this. I accept that, and I'd like the opinion of the Auditor General. If there was a specific provision, and that's all legal, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But then how do you know that all of those transactions were overpaid? Do you have a method of actually, because someone else in the report has said that your monitoring was non-effective. So have you gone and had it checked out all of those payments to see that other people were not overpaid?
When we checked every single one in the transaction, we took a sample of those that had done over that particular period of time. And when we look at them, we then became clear to us that it was involving cases where agents think that it's possible that let's say that the 100, we took out of a sample of 40, and the other 60 that we didn't look at, if we look at each one, we may see something different.
Yeah. Could we just give an opinion from the IG, please?
Jason, on this issue, I think it's important to note that the one comment that was made is that the urgent prescription services that was necessary. Now, during our discussions with management, we actually did confirm with them that for this specific service provider, he did not indicate in his quotation that there would be a higher rate for urgent transcription. So he should have quoted the same amount. He couldn't just go and quote more. But secondly, the bigger issue here is the fact that when payments are made, you must go back and see when you approve the quotation, what would be agreed upon fee, and only make payments on that. And that's the issue we're trying to highlight here. So it's true. It's only two payment factors that fell in our sample, and it was only 1,100 grand. But the principle is, as the gentleman indicated, it could be much, much more. So that's why we feel justice must go back and verify those payments specifically from that service provider, because we have proof that they were mistakes already. And that they should put controls in place to ensure that in the future, before payments are made, there will be a check back to the agreed upon quotation price.
Thank you.
Right.
Did
you think that's a fair comment from the Auditor General's office?
It is fair comment. That's why we referred to our legal section to advise, and that I still think that under the circumstances it's fair and reasonable for a service provider to sort of ask for the higher fee than is normal. Because in those cases, it was not normal circumstances for that work to be done, even though the quote original was for a specific type of.
Okay, then my next question basically follows from that, and perhaps it's not a relevant question then anymore, except that I think it's important that you put this on record. The other comment was that the AG says that you did not comply with paragraph 8.2.7b of the Department of Finance instructions, and that you did not certify that the services were rendered satisfactorily by service providers for payment documentation to be, in other words, before you make a payment, it's incumbent on you to certify that you actually got the service and that the service was provided in terms of a given contract or tender, whatever. And clearly that wasn't done. Now, in my view, the reason that provision is there is to prevent things like this from happening. Now, still doing it up front, now you've got to go back now, because I suggest that's what you should have to do now. Go back and check each one of those transactions and see whether in fact the payment was correct. Because you see, the once you open the door by ignoring instructions, you open the door for corruption. That creates an opportunity for somebody to just simply pay somebody an additional amount. And then say, oh, this is because this is a, you know. That's why we have these instructions. We're not nitpicking. We're only talking about a few thousand names that when you replicate that throughout the whole government. You have all government departments and entities, millions of rand of procurement to tax rights. If you allow those little gaps to open up and those doors to turn open, then it can cost the tax rights a huge amount of money. And that's what this act is trying to stop. So Chair, you know, even though that seems not a material amount, I think it's critically important. And I believe that they should go back and do that, but you know, we won't make recommendations now, we'll discuss that amongst ourselves. I don't know if you would like to just respond to that. Okay, Jenny, on this particular issue of payments, my last question really just comes back to the fact that are you going to then try and recover money that was incorrectly paid to some of these service providers? So do you mean, I mean, you're fine, or are you going to recover that money from?
Let me say, we'll go back and look at the transactions that the auditor was suggesting we want to check the extent of the challenge in the event. And where we've made more payments than was quoted, we'll look at whether there was justification to recover it. So it's going to be a challenging thing, but we will seek to recover the money. And I think what we can do is give a report there from this, of our challenging thing to look at.
Yeah, I still wanted to check whether it can only be updated on the monthly basis in terms of how far you're going for that, not by then. Honorable
Chancellor? So the pure things, you know, covered the payment side of what I was doing. But there are other issues which are sort of grey areas. They've got to do with systems and payment.
Arising from the report.
Yeah. Everything right to the report.
No. What I'm saying there are issues that emanate from this report in front of us.
The other members may have questions too, but let me put one more question. This is on page 5.1.5. It's got to do with restrictive horizontal business practices. Question that I ask is simply to explain what appropriate action, if any, has been taken by the department relating to restrictive horizontal business practices that emerged in the quotations that were submitted. And then, of course, what seems to be taken by the business to again. That's page 5, paragraph 5.1.5.
We've looked at it, and the conclusion that we have reached is that it went our while to refer the matter to the relevant authority for further investigation. In our view, although we appear to be established as a fact there was such a practice, we believe that from the same basis, there is a suggestion that there may have been contravention of the competition legislation. So we're referring for the full investigation.
I think that's it. They have referred it for a full investigation. This is a contravention of the competition. It's not the SMA. But I mean, clearly it is a contravention of the law. And clearly, if there is cause to take action, will you do so?
We would do so. Also, possibly looking at this cause. There's a separate issue to that. Because it is four different terms. All bidding of the courting to be competitive, but with a common plan, a common path.
And what is the sort of amount, the quantum that's involved here, in terms of money? And if you have that figure roughly,
Yeah, I mean, it's for the whole contract because of the. Because of all the bidders, it's 4 separate terms that are bidding for the full extent of the contract.
So it actually involves the total amount of the contract, which I think is, was it 20 or 30 million?
40 million.
40
million.
Okay. Well, I think that's quite serious. I think that, I'm comfortable that the media is going to be sure that they are looking into this matter. Chair, I think I have a few other questions, but they are not directly related to the money. But there are other members of the committee who would like to participate, so I will rest my case for the future.
Thank you very much, Honourable question. Any member with any particular question at the end of this report?
Right. I see at the end of the report, on page 8, there are comments by the accounting officer in terms of the measures that they would like to see taken to address the findings of the Auditor General. Is it possible for you to take us through each of those areas? All I need are one or two liners, not a full debrief, to see whether we're making progress or not. I think if you look at our program, you see that the last item they update on CISO. We had an engagement with them. They promised to give us an update. And we more or less have a sense from time to time of where they are and how far they've gone. Now, you've made recommendations that your CFO should deal with. Now, 5-6 months down the line, where are we in relation to these recommendations that you have made?
Thank you, Chair. Everything here has been done. It's currently in place. The only one outstanding item is to finalize the appointment of full-time official. And really what has changed in the delay is the business process and job evaluation exercises. We have created the post, but they have to go through job evaluation. That's the only report that we are waiting, and as soon as that's done, we'll then advertise accordingly. But all of the other points have been given effect.
I'm implying that the bullet point number one that deals with lack of appropriately qualified and skilled staff has not been addressed.
No, it has been addressed. The people that are there have been trained and appropriately qualified, but they are not. Some of them are not permanent officials of the department. So it should be conducted that they would have brought them both through the body shop arrangement with them for the body. Simply because we have to finalize the job evaluation before we allocate a budget for full-time official. So that is what is awaiting finalization. So we created the post, they are now being created to indicate what proper grades that we can take for
DPS. But I mean, to this post, they won't go to current.
They do have those posts.
So you have addressed bullet point number 3. Here the post is appropriate staff.
Yes.
And what about the last bullet point on page 8?
Yes, you can tell me every time before they take the time.
Reconstitute. Has this police been reconstituted? What the hell is the situation?
Completely
useless. And this area around inadequate document control, because I think that was the point that was coming over and over again. What measures are in place? Or what measures have been put in place?
Well, we've done a couple of things. The first is the processing and recording every step that takes place, that gets done. As far as finding is concerned, that's ongoing because we're looking at it as part of the whole departmental finding system is concerned. So we have provided for the space to file some of the documents from this particular process, but we're looking at assessing the whole of the filing system. So that's part of the broader picture is ongoing. It's not yet finalized, but it's ongoing.
Now, what about the last paragraph, especially so far as it relates to compliance? Because of staff members, I think we started on it. The measures that we're taking.
On the suppliers' chair, the opinion was that the amount paid and quoted was very reasonable under the circumstances. And on that basis, we thought not to continue that.
One issue that I think we've not covered, just the one loss, I've been following through the docket. If it hadn't been sort of covered, please stop it. And that's the whole question of the verification of information. And it has to do with preferential procurement, and we all know that there's good reason for that. It's just feeding into the branch of people, so therefore, you know, it's a very important issue. However, once again, when the more complicated the system becomes, the more opportunities there are for fraud and corruption. Now, the Auditor General, I will read the whole paragraph, but the Auditor General points out there that the information that was provided was not reliable. And they then did a recalculation, and this has got to do with the distances. I don't want to go into it, you just clear to understand the situation. And the AG is concerned about that, where he says, first of all, you didn't stick to your own rule, and secondly, you didn't give the information calculated incorrectly, and that led to the wrong person getting, or the wrong institution getting the contract, if I have this case correctly. So, what I'm asking now is, what steps have you taken to ensure that this doesn't happen again? That you stick to those regulations at all times, and then have you taken any steps against any offenders in respect of a wrong tender being awarded? And if so, what's the 12? Do you think you've taken steps in all these issues?
Yeah, no. I think it goes back to the same issue on the road trip, that they are taking certain measures against the certain officials. What you can look forward to is when they send us the information, it's good to check whether this particular incident is covered among the officials that have been dealt with. And if they are not, it's only then that we can take it up with them to find out why I have been let down. But since at this point in time it's not have the situation in terms of which particular area, let's await the report that I'm going to give us.
Okay, so I think that was my first question, was what steps have been put in place to make sure that they adhere to the differential procurement regulations at all times in the future?
Yeah, again, I don't want to ask for the department. I'm here to assist you up with questions. But I think when I asked them about the recommendation on page 8 and the responses that they gave, we're clearly saying that they've put measures in place that will ensure that minimizes, if not eliminates, the possibility of people deviating from such procedures and policies. So it will be more at the level of implementation and practice that they will see whether the measures that are in place are effective or not.
I accept that, but I think just for the record, I think that is an issue that was raised by the Auditor General, and it's good that it's on the record.
Correct, yeah, I'm saying, Honorable Trent, the comment point 6 of the accounting officer comments and reacts to all the findings of the Auditor General, and it has put in place the measures that they can address them. So I'm saying, let us wait and see if what they are telling us works or doesn't work. Then we'll call them again. Right.
Thank you, Chair. I hope that this hasn't been covered, but I'd just like to know from the gentleman regarding the contracts and how they were advertised. The contract RFQ 2005-01 was advertised on 1st of August 2005. And it closed the 5th of August 2005, which means it's 4 days. Then that contract was cancelled on the 31st of August, the same month. But then the next contract was RFQ 2005-02. That again was also advertised on the 19th of September 2005. And it closed on the 23rd of September 2005, also 4 days. Now, my question is, since you advertised it and it was only open for 4 days, where was it advertised? and if it was advertised, well, maybe one should just find out where it was advertised.
I'll double check that information, but the standard procedure is that you advertise in the UC. Well, you should have been in the UC.
So, I mean, if you advertise something for 4 days, and it means it appears, say, for instance, if you're lucky on a Monday, it closes on a Thursday. And I can understand if it was telephonic quotation, but if it was advertised in the media, it's the first time in my life I've heard of a contract that's advertised in the printed media for 4 days. Maybe if Mrs. Gom can give us some clarity now.
Thank you, Chief. I think we need to look at the whole process to understand it better. The tender, as mentioned in the background information of the audited general report, the tender or the bid document that we worked on was cancelled on the advice of National Treasury to give specific errors in the tender document. Obviously, our services in terms of the quotation budget came to an end in September. And we were put under pressure in terms of coming up with a new arrangement to have these services because we cannot do without those services. Which is why we went for the RFQ 200501, which was then obviously changed to 200502 because we prefer the supplier to apply. So the urgency of the service really led to us following that approach. We do acknowledge that, but in this particular case, due to the urgency, we have to create a
I understand the urgency, but I still don't know what approach you take. Did you ask for telephonic quotations, or did you advertise in the media?
We'll double check it and then come back to you next. But the procedure provides that all available letters within Public Gazette and the media are supposed to be used to advertise also. That's the same
procedure. Yeah, it's only okay, well maybe yes, it's the chip
and
go to the best
of all. And Chief, we just follow up on that. It was a quotation. One should differentiate between a tender and a quotation. In terms of special regulations, a tender must be at the top for 34 days. A quotation can be shorter due to urgency, etc. When you look at the financial instructions of justice itself, they said that if an amount is more than 200,000, they must contact all the service providers on their list of service providers, or as many as possible. Now, in fact, they just contact all 50 service providers that are on the list that can give construction services. And they sent through the RFQ to those individuals. They actually even contacted three more. So that is why it is such a short period. We do not have a concern over the period because it is a quotation, and the fact that they contact everybody in terms of their own instructions is also fine.
Okay, now that covers me because I was just worried about if you are saying to me that there are 50 service providers and they were all contacted and they actually contacted three more, then I'm covered. Because it is a weakness, the fact that people can, in an emergency, can ask for telephonic quotations, but then the criteria they use for who they pick to get a quotation sometimes is where the problem comes in. But in this case, if everybody was phoned, then I'm happy with that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
We have the new service provider whose contract, each of whose contract is 3 years. So those that are appointed are currently in place and they'll run for another 2 years. They started last June
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable Member, what we have put in place is a training intervention. We are currently having accredited service providers which are funded by Treasury. These training courses are being funded by Treasury. So we have, since 2004, January 2004 to date, have on a monthly basis been conducting workshops and training, and we have invited a number of departments, and most departments are responding to this training. And to ensure exactly the question of planning that needs to be equated in this whole process, that they do adhere to. Yes, we do have this measure in place.
Yes, Honourable
Chair, I think on a matter of information, we received information which we asked for, which gave us a list of the service providers that have now been given a 3-year contract. And it seems like an interesting reading here, maybe we can just give an explanation. In four of the provinces, KZN, Northern Province, Western Cape, and Northern Cape, which is a mixture of high population, small provinces, and then vast rural areas, you know, so it's a good mix. One service provider got the contract at R6.50 per page in all of those provinces, according to the document I have. Whereas in other provinces, the page cost almost double the R6.50. That's the Eastern Cape, Mpumalanga, Free State, and Northern West. I was just wondering why was that
You know, we're paying double almost the amount that we're paying in the four provinces. And there's no sort of substantial, with a good mix of distance, volume, all those sort of things. Perhaps you could just give us why that happened. Did you inquire as to why they took in such high prices?
Thank you, Chair. I think the Honourable Member may have the award that was one of those that were considered the RFQ, because the figures that I have here are different. But another point, because you can't afford even hearing of difference. What most of the time accounts for the difference is the volume. The size of the province doesn't always affect the volume of work done in those cases. For example, a lot of the work is done in Gauteng, which is the smallest of all of the provinces. So when they do quote, they look at the extent of the work that they have to do and the pressure under which they have to do it. So that usually is the reason behind the price differential. Then the other purely profit to the more issue.
Yeah, in other words, in the final contract that they have now, are those variances much less than in the RFQ RFQ? I mean,
we want to bring this to a close now, and once again, thank you, Richard, for coming to share, especially most importantly, the measures that you've taken subsequent to this report, and to say that I think what the report highlights basically is the need to strengthen management functions in terms of monitoring and supervision. These might have occurred to a large extent to poor planning and not so adequate monitoring processes. Like with agreed, let's get the information in terms of the official budget, two measures that we've taken in relation to some of the countries that I highlighted here. And also let us get on an ongoing basis some of the unfolding processes arising out of your follow-up of this report. And will only be too heavy if we do not have a recurrence of this kind of things. The most important thing is the strengthening of the management function. And we have the policies in place and everything in place, but if there is no strict monitoring, you'll find that non-compliance arises. And we will not want to again talk about the lack of capacity. Recall that here in the year our hearing issue did not go the full distance because it felt like the department is plagued by such levels of incapacity, then maybe whatever other questions may have arising out of all matters that have been identified in the annual report might not serve much purpose. So we hope that the report that will come after next week will indeed highlight some element of movement in terms of trying to strengthen the management and administration of the resources and program of the department. We want to thank you very much. We believe we have done justice to this report. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair.
Again, just like in justice, we were dealing with a specific issue, not necessarily the totality of the department's function. I will hand over to Commissioner Nede, who will lead us, who will take us through.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. And as first, let me thank the Office of the Auditor General for a very readable and very well prepared report. I say thank you both for the hard work. And then, coming to the Accounting Authority and the Director General. Let me first say that we do appreciate your hard work, we do appreciate your service, and we are very grateful for the service that you are doing to the country. So when we talk to you here, we are talking to you about these specific concerns, but we appreciate the service you have done to the country. It's, sometimes you may come out quite central, but it is because of what you see. It's not that, not personally directed to you as people or to you as a department. It's a concern we share as part of the nation. The nation being you and me and the rest of the people. I just wanted to say that because sometimes we come off to be coming for thank you. Let me then come to the first question. The first question is, could the accounting officer and the accounting authority indicate to the committee what progress has been made with regard to the review of the accounting officer's procurement procedure, that is AOPP, in order to ensure compliance with the supply chain guide for accounting officers or authorities and the guidelines on hourly pay rates for consultants, which have been raised as by the Auditor General in this thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me start off to thank you, Chair Hassan, for the flexibility that you displayed in trying to accommodate our difficult schedule. I'm pleased that we've now found pick up the time to process this matter, because it is an important matter. And perhaps in responding to the question, I just need to say that this report, this performance audit report, is one that I initiated in my own responsibility as soon as I had acceded to the position just as an acting DG, because I and concerned by what appeared to be very weak and very lax standards in the procurement of the consulting and the public way. And so I then engaged the auditor chancellor to say, can you please help me to investigate this matter, which then resulted in this, in this report. But with respect to the question, we have now corrected the whole gap that appeared in relation to the tender process. We have supply chain guides in place. We've been implementing that anyway. Although the accounting officer's procurement procedures did not reflect that, in practice, in fact, the supply chain guide has not been implemented in relation to procurement and especially in relation to procurement of consulting. The accounting officer's procurement procedures have now been updated to incorporate all of the areas that have not been incorporated in the documentation. We have established a supply chain management unit that reports to the chief financial officer. We now have a bid adjudication committee that I have appointed that adjudicates requests for the use of consultants. And we comply to the set thresholds that have been prescribed by National Treasury. We have implemented demand management, adjudication management, as I indicated, logistics management, and risk management. And all of these are in place. And then, of course, we comply with the supply chain guidelines that have been introduced by National Treasury. So those gaps in relation to the procedures, which is a document that the Auditor General also is relied on, and the actual practices, the gap has been corrected. So I think the system is fully compliant with these
guidelines. Do you know my briefing from this situation to the status quo right now? Have you encountered any hidden problems perhaps, and then these two, what are the hidden problems?
I'm going to ask the chief financial officer to help me with that, and the head of the director of procurement in the department. But to my knowledge, there is no major problem that we've encountered that we couldn't overcome, or at least that has been brought to my attention. I think one of these has been very straightforward, but I don't know if the chief financial officer may want to say something.
Thanks, Chair. My name is Paul. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to do so. I think, let me just reemphasize what the DGS said. The practice was not reflected in the documentation of the accounting officer's procurement policies. Essentially, we practiced everything that was in supply chain management. However, and I think you'll find largely in government departments that officials tend not to understand the supply chain management. So what we have done is, on a monthly basis, we have information and training sessions within the department to which all staff members are invited. And in fact, we get a tremendous response with respect to that. And our audit report and management letter for the last financial year clearly reflect that, because there isn't any substantial issues that have come out from the audit.
Thank you very much. My second question will be in connection with what is reflected on page 7F of the report, that is your report, your comment as the accounting officer. That is where the question arises. Could you then indicate the progress that has been made with regard to the completion, approval and implementation of the guidelines on the appointment of consultants. And does the guidelines address the transfer of skills to the DCI staff by consultants? Thank you.
Thank you. There's no guideline specifically for the appointment of consultants. We deal with this matter as part of the general procurement dispensation, which is based on the principles that we referred to in the earlier question. But any submission that requests the use of consulting has to include this provision. So it's a standard requirement that we impose to indicate whether there will be skills transfer, and if so, how the skills transfer will be affected as such. So it's part of the procurement disciplines that we put in place. So, and of course, in the terms of reference, putting together the musical concept. Just before you go on to the comment, I understand your comments on page 7, from page 7. Yeah. To be implying that these are measures that you are going to take to try and change the situation around. And the point that is raised F on a guideline on the appointment of consultants. You have committed yourself to compiling such a guideline. And you are saying that guideline has not been drawn. Is it still to be drawn, or you have changed your approach to that, because your response seems to say how consultants are appointed will now be dealt with within the general framework that guides the operations of the department. Is it still going to be drawn, or is it that where you are now going to do it differently?
No, thanks. No, you're quite right. Yeah, just a minute.
You want to put a line into that, yes?
In fact, my reference is this document. And F reads, a guideline on the appointment of consultants will be compiled and addressed the transfer of skills to the DTI staff in the appointment of consultants. That is part of the comments by the council. So that was what I was asking the honorable chair.
No,
that's
the chair, you're quite right. The answer provided says that this is part of the procurement of consultants is incorporated in the accounting officer's procurement procedure. We have not created a special guideline for consultants. Obviously, we had an immediate concern, immediate problems that we've addressed in relation to the accounting officer's procurement procedures. I don't think that there is a need specifically to do guidelines focused on consultants per se. They may well be in the future, but currently we are dealing with this regulation within the context of the handling of the procurement procedure. No. I think our concern arises from the fact that it is part of your own comment, or merely what is valid.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll go then to page the question to the accounting officer would be, could you please indicate what progress has been made to ensure that the cost of appointing the consultant is compared to alternatives to ensure that the DTI takes the most economic option?
In fact, the surprisingly there's this concern of that the cost sometimes of having these consultants that from that need to institute this report to establish under what conditions do we use consultants and for what purpose, as it were. The dispensation that we put in place as captured in the accounting officer's personnel procedures that incorporates the supply chain guidelines does obviously have criteria that allow us to establish whether there's an absolute need, and sometimes we do turn down a request for consultants if indeed we can satisfy the need through internal arrangements, through greater cooperation by experts within the department, and of course sometimes through relying on our agencies where often the capacity is located. So yes, we do impose some rigorous analysis, and we only use these consultants where it's absolutely necessary. I think the CFO wants to add to this.
Yeah, can I just put this right and then you can write on it as well. I'm looking at page further. Point number D. If you look at it vis-a-vis C on page 6, is it striking a pessimistic note? Or is it merely being pragmatic? I mean, C, including D above C on page 6, the first bullet point on page 6, B above C. And then C actually is sure that the product assesses the need for educational service. But page 7 D says, although options other than engaging consultant might not be specifically addressed in all the submissions led the same with the department and the committee. I think we're moving from a premise here that says that we're not necessarily looking at the proper management of consultants, but we're looking at the minimization, if not elimination, of using consultants in the department by appointing appropriately qualified staff to the job. So, when I read C and B as a group, we're moving in the right direction. But when I read B on page 7, it's like we're falling flat on our stomachs again. I'm not sure, but maybe the CO4 can clarify that as he put an addition to what he just said.
So, let me ask you, so that you have to understand what B on page 7 refers. It states that historically, because the audit was based on an examination of a number of submissions, although in those submissions, it may not have been indicated whether there's a rigorous analysis and other options that you consider. But the procedures followed by the tender committee do themselves interrogate it. But now, the situation as it stands now is that we have imposed a requirement at all submissions in order to make it past a particular threshold for us to consider, have to include this provision. This is now in the current situation. At that time,
you know, although the submission was dissolved, but the tender processes were able to pick up where there was the weakness in respect of this particular check.
I just want to concur with the DG in respect to that. What we also do is at that time the submissions didn't take care of this issue. In fact, the individual making the submission were called in front of the tender committee to explain, and these were obviously ministers at the time. But I just wanted to ask the issue that the DG spoke about earlier in terms of cost comparison. In addition to looking internally, whether the work cannot be done internally, if we do decide to go externally, there's two ways you can do it. You can either go on a quotation basis, then we use the DGSA guidelines to ensure that it within those guidelines the tariff. Alternatively, we go to open bidding process, which is over 200,000 rand. And then obviously the tender committee takes care of the process around that just to ensure that there is a comparison in terms of the costs that have been quoted.
Yeah, and let me just check. Did your efforts perhaps include shifting the level of authority to ensure that it's the cost that we have in the Department of Consultants?
So I'm not sure if I understand the question, if the honourable member could kindly repeat the question.
Yes, in fact, what would happen in cases where there is a major concern about the second aspect of a business? There would be a shift in level, the superior position would then oversee or make sure that this happens. It wouldn't be the same level that we're dealing with the problem. So it would, until perhaps we are satisfied that the lower level can manage in the desired way, it would temporarily be moved to the next senior level. That is what I mean by the level of.
Let me see if I provide the answer. I understand the question. In certain instances, the specialist for major items, as I don't think we indicated that, at about the same time as I asked this report to be done, I also made this requirement that I approve all consultants in case. So it goes through all of these processes, the tender process and everything. They check the contract criteria. But it also finally comes to me to my office, which was not the case at the time. So I sign off and I satisfy myself that everything is proper. But also sometimes we refer this to our executive committee, where I speak with the manager, so we examine the major consultancy. For example, if you look at the consultancy into the automotive industry, which is quite major, has got general implications for the rest of the department. Something like that. In addition to having procedures, from a policy point of view, additional oversight, it comes to executive. I don't know if that's
Then my next question would be on the current number of staff vacancies. Where is it now, and then is it at the desired level, and then if so, what are the percentages are we talking about now?
In the year up to March 2007, we filled
13 sub-agencies, which was a 60% reduction in the vacancies that existed as of the 1st of April 2006. The current vacancy rate of 27% hasn't changed, however. And this is due to a number of factors, mainly staff turnover. Some of the appointments are in fact internal, so we promote people from internal. I've always said to senior people that we should try and affirm the people that have stayed in the department and are qualified to assist the senior position. So what may happen is that one vacancy will be filled, but another is created. And so filling vacancies is an ongoing thing. We have and we did speak about this
what means practically is that we will move people to fill in long-standing vacancies, so we will just create new ones. We have moved, there has been displacement, but there has been no distance covered, so to speak. And then I think our major area of interest was it is more on being able to bring people from outside to come in, because in that way then you are reducing the level and the number of vacancies that you have. The internal promotion part, I think it's a very good policy that you are rewarding people who are loyal as long as they have skills, so people should stick around, but it does not assist us in addressing the numbers of vacancies that you have, the numbers of static. I think I just wanted to magnify that point, because that is the area of concern.
Sure. No, certainly, Chair. I was just wanting to indicate that you have seen 27% about a year ago. That may give an impression on the face of it that we're not addressing this thing. But we're fully seized with this thing. But it's a challenging issue of vacancy. Yes, of course, we are, in certain instances, are aggressively looking for people from outside. We have engaged specialized recruitment agencies and headhunters for particular skills. What that has told us is that we are operating in a highly competitive environment for skills. It's a challenge. We're talking to DPSA to see whether we can get the ability to provide attractive remuneration packages. The last time when he indicated that we are the type of a job for the CFO, CIO, the Chief Information Officer, at a particular level. When the person was offered the job, someone else was having a better package in the private sector. Because our skills, we compete directly with the private sector. So the issue is complex, but we're seized with it. We also have networks with the universities where we are targeting master's students, and some of them are beginning to come into the department. It's a constant challenge that we're fully seized.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the next one of vacancies is a big problem to the Department of Trade and Industry. But looking at it from where I sit, it would look as though it would be easier to fill junior vacancies if people are promoted up. Except those vacancies at the junior level as well are highly technical. But
government has went and unfortunately are linked to the offices of the PI in Pretoria. If it's still the same offices, I would guess even with comparable salaries, it would be very difficult to attract people because of the way the offices are. I mean, some of these people who are high in demand also are looking for a particular address to be working at, and sometimes the salary from their home may not suffice to support the bank.
What is it about this? I don't know. I walk up and down the street of travel almost every weekend.
The offices are not that safe. Let me put you like this.
Let me put you like this.
For senior managers is up to date, and is it being considered before tenders are awarded, immediately before tenders are awarded? Thank you.
Yes, yes, the database is with senior to date. We, apart from the incident that was referred to in this report, then we have not had any major conflict of interest issues. The someone from the tender office also participates in the evaluation of bids to ensure that the calling is correct, that conflict of interest forms are filled as required as well. So we are managing the initial conflict of interest eventually. And by the way, I don't know whether the honorable member knows our new office in San Antonio. It's on that maybe talking to our old offices in Princeton, because our new offices are where the MD of government and even the private sector.
Okay,
oh, the office in Princeton, please. Your local
company,
your local company, is it our office?
So I think that we are satisfied about addressing conflict of interest in your department. Then that leads me to the next question. Could you please inform the committee on the progress made to ensure that the requirements of the Preferential Procure Policy Act of 2000 are adhered to, and that the approval tender evaluation criteria are used during the tender evaluation? My reference is 5.1.7. Thank you.
Yeah, this is one area that we have corrected the inconsistency of scoring on the EE. There is a technical response that I'm going to ask either the tender director for the tender office or the CFO to address in the scoring, in how the scoring is conducted. But I think the inconsistency that was referred to has been removed, and we are applying the criteria as provided for in the applicable legislation, which is the PPT Act. Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
You got my comment on this finding. The specific finding relates to period in 2003, 2004, and the four tenders in the sample that was identified. since that period, we've implemented processes as indicated by my DG that a procurement advisor or an official from the team office will attend all tender evaluations. I will see to it that they comply to the requirements of the PFA. They will see to it that they comply with the declaration of interest. And the specific official will also be responsible for the calculation of points scored in the in accordance with the terms of PFA. So yes, we've addressed all of that concern to the final.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm done with my session, Chairperson, for the moment. I'm done for now.
Thank you very much, can I just check if I missed some of the points or some of your questions when I was building off at some point here. But I see that in the report of the AG, it's indicated that at some point you secured the service of the CEO on a consultant basis. Is the gentleman excuse the consultant?
He just said to me that he wishes the
he
was. No, that was before you arrived. He is in fact a correction. His appointment is a correction.
Okay. I understand why he wishes to. Because in terms of the information that is here, the consultant fees or service fees and the salary, 6.8 million, at a time when a full-time CFO was getting about 600,000 per year. So I don't understand why you wish to be a consultant.
His appointment, we have not used consultants in the area of financial management.
Now, there was also a shortcoming in terms of the AOPP. It did not have as a requirement the skill transfer for consultants as a treatment for the department. And there was also no benchmarking for our rates. Have these been corrected?
Yes, they have. We did speak to those specific those two items in one of my responses that I did address.
I was going to follow up the item. I didn't hear that. Right. Rukul. Also, moved since morning.
Pardon?
We already had your sweet voice since morning.
My hope was. Chairperson, while still on the consultancy, I see the definition here. There's a definition here of, in terms of the auditor's report, a consultant is an entity, whether an individual, a partnership, or a cooperative, that. Right, then the definition here, I don't know whether it is deliberately. There's a document titled Policy Strategy to Guide Uniformity in Procurement and Form Processing Government. This document is the one that gave rise to some of these PMSA and other related regulations. And on this document was produced way back in 2003, that 7th of April 2003. And there it explains about the appointment of consultants. And I see the definition here different. It says primary reason for appointment of consultants. consultants are engaged principally for the following reasons: to provide specialized services for limited periods without any obligation of permanent employment. That is what the document says. But here, I think the Department of Trade and Industry, perhaps deliberately, did not want to commit itself by limited periods or without obligation of permanent employment. I just want to check whether they are aware of this, because my impression here, and furthermore, it says to benefit from superior knowledge, transfer of skills, and upgrading of a knowledge base while executing an assignment. It is just a question that you just asked, Chairperson, that this document explains in the most explicit terms why we appoint consultants and whether it will be for a number of years or so. And according to the auditors here, the consultant, the BCI indicated an internal report issued on July 2005 that for the past number of years, extensive use has been made of consultancy by the BCI. Now, there's a conflict here. The policy produced by government. On one hand, we have the definition of what the DT thinks about consultants. And now here, the number of years, no specific period. Could we get an idea of exactly where the DTI is with respect to all these conflicting ideas, both from government and from the DTI? Your definition of what the consultant is differs from what this document says about consultants, even the number of years that you have got to engage in the consultant.
I will allow Honorable Stevens and Honorable Baker to get on with their questions, and hope that in the avalanche of questions that they will be asking, your concern will be covered. If it is not covered, then I'll give you an opportunity to raise it. Just that what they are going to be asking on is basically to realize a set deal in part of this particular. So I don't want us to encroach and mess up before they even start. So let me even turn it over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm reading page 8, basically, of the formative report. But before I begin, DG, can I say that we have to commend you heartily for having taken this action. And it is extremely sound management procedure that you've undertaken. And questions regarding the history of this, you must not in any way see as being reflected upon yourself. But my first question is, just for the record, there is one incident is pointed out that in November 2005, the contract between the consortium and the DTI was still not signed. Has it been signed now? Has that been is this agreement between yourself and that company being taken out of the way in the contract clause?
Yes, we resolved the issue in the contract.
Thank you. Then the following question is, how many consultants were on contract at any particular time that are not
I was distracted.
Did they respond to your first question?
Yes.
What was the response?
The response was
that it's been resolved, the issue between the two parties, and that the contract between them has now been signed.
Okay.
How many consultants were at any stage employed or used without having signed contracts?
And are any of them still used without signed contracts? Are they still unsigned contractors, in other words, in the department?
At that time, for which this report covers, it was the only one that was in Africa. Since then, all consultants are fired. The services are not the case before the contract is applied. I think the CFO wants to add to.
No, that's what he said. I think if I just put this in fact, what the DGS said is absolutely correct. But just to put this into context, what it has known, after 10 of the persons have gone out and the service provider has been shortlisted and essentially accepted, the DGI decided to add additional conditions to the contract, which then became a dispute. And in that process, obviously, we need, and this is essentially for internal audit function. And the contract was already on site doing the work, and we tried to change the conditions, but it subsequently been resolved in time. But to our knowledge, there wasn't any other contract that was not signed with the service provider providing the service to the department.
Thank you. So what you're saying really is this is a single exception to the rule. Because the idea that I got from the whole report is that it was in fact not just a single exception, because your own comment under A says, as from 2005, the Departmental Technical Committee has made the signing of a service level agreement contract compulsory, which seems to indicate that it was not compulsory beforehand, although normal common law guilty, you should have a contract. But it seems that if it was introduced only in 2005,
sorry, for the response to that. In fact, the terms of reference and the response says to inspect the contract in itself. However, we've always had contract signed prior to a service provider. And this was an isolated instance where we tried to have additional conditions attached to it. Maybe that particular response would have been clarified.
Then the second question is, in 5.2.2 you say, or rather the AG says, that the AOPP indicates that the person nominated as project manager for consulting services must forward a performance report. And in your comments again about the service level agreement, you say it's more focused on outlining the scope of work, performance requirements, reporting, and it raises the question, who reports on the performance? Is it the project manager, or is it the contractor himself who must give a report, or is it both?
Well, it is both. The contractor has to deliver a service, and sometimes it can give a report, but sometimes it can be a particular service accompanied by a report. The project manager has the responsibility to evaluate whether the service is in accordance with the standard that has been agreed as part of the contract. And so on that basis, when he signs off, that payment is made. I think this is the thing that we clarified as part of the new dispensation, that no invoice is paid. So the payment of the invoice suggests that a service has been received. No payment is made unless signed off by the project manager. Because the project manager is the best place to evaluate whether the service has indeed been performed. But over and above, there's a random check as part of internal audit on particular contract to ascertain whether the reports reflect the truth in relation to the debt.
Thank you. Because what is concerning is that in 5.2.2 the ADC, however, on request, no monthly report would be submitted to the Auditor General as proof of progress reporting to the Procurement Union or to inform finance except for the evidence attached to the payment. So, you know, I don't know whether that's something that has been changed or whether it's still a continuous practice, because you could find no monthly reports. For example, for progress payments, that would be absolutely essential, surely.
No, what I'm speaking to is the situation currently as a corrective action in response to this. Obviously, at the time, they don't have a major consent, but I don't know if the CFO would like to clarify.
Yeah, no.
Honorable Stewart,
unless if you want to pursue this, but I hear the DGC saying that what you're saying is a corrective response to what is in the report, so I think it should be fine.
Yeah, I accept that.
Okay.
The only other matter that I would like to address is your comments under A, which says, it sets out what the FLA does, the service level agreement. It says it's more focused on outlining the scope of work, the performance requirements reporting, and the relationship with management. Where do you negotiate the standards to which the work is delivered? Surely that should be part of the agreement. Or on what basis is the standard to which the standard requirements of the work to be delivered? Where is that agreed between yourself and the contractor, the consultant?
No, it's the whole process thing. First, starting off with a need, the submission of the need, and then the negotiation of the milestones, or the agreement, the combination of the milestones. Before we even go out to contract, all of these things are first out for in terms of reference actually clarified. And then of course once the contract is entered into, the process is being monitored by the project manager once approval is obtained. But the SLA is an instrument of monitoring the standards of service as set out in terms of reference.
You see, Chair, my concern here is that the standards to which performance is required from a contractor needs to be agreed. If it's not specifically part of the agreement, then you could have an argument as to what was reasonable compliance or not. And you could find yourself in a court action being with a claim for payment based on that we gained substantial performance, which would entitle them to payment. But the substantial performance might not be the performance that you had in mind specifically, or the standard of performance that you require for the purposes of the contract. And that's why I suggest that it is extremely important to put your standards of work to be delivered, must form part of the agreement so that it can be tested against the agreement whether they make the standards or not. In other words, it's like you're imposing your conditions after they started work. You can't, when a guy delivers the work, say that this is not up to standard, and he says, what's the standard? That's my concern.
What you're describing is, in fact, the practice currently. The concerns arose in relation to that one incident where a contract or a dispute, because he wanted to impose additional terms or additional standards once the tender document had gone out. So we try as much as possible, this is part of contract law, we try as much as possible to spell out the needs and the standards upfront so that when people respond to contract on that basis, it's very difficult to introduce once the tender document has gone out or the contract has been negotiated to introduce the results.
So I take the point that you could at least develop that concept. We don't have a problem.
Chair, just my final question on the reporting on problems. The AG's office mentions that the DGI did not comply with these requirements and the only information listed in the DGI's annual reports 2004 and 2005 was a line entry. I assume that this is going to be rectified in the report that we will be receiving shortly.
Because it
has been.
Yes, sir? There's been one more report after this problem where we could rectify that. So we intend to maintain that trust.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Stevens. Honourable Baker.
Chairperson, I've been practically covered with the monitoring and the evaluation of the work by performed by consultants by Mr. Stevens and also by Comrade Gourmet. I'll just go a bit deeper into some of the aspects, particularly with when we start monitoring and evaluating the process. Surely there has been progress, and it seems to me that skills of the past have been addressed. But in this particular respect, just in contact with the consultant, which didn't sign the agreement, surely it must be absolute negligence to have a consultant putting on the job without an agreement, because if an agreement is not signed, it is not an agreement. That person is in an ad hoc position there, is performing work, and it is totally, totally unthinkable and unheard of that you could then start paying him and giving a payment for a job on which there is not a contract. So it is a bit more rough than what it seems to be at high level on this particular position. That would be my third question. Is there anything being done? Who has been responsible for the not signing? I won't call it necessarily maladministration, but shall I say lack of administration that has happened. Somebody must have been responsible for it, because the person who accepted the tender, handed over the tender, surely should have got an agreement.
It's an individual. I would have the CFO to assist me in relation to that, because this was at a time when we didn't have an internal audit function, and I think it was a contract in relation to internal audit, as I understand it. I don't know the person's consent. I think many of them would have left because it was before my time, as it were, but the CFO can shed more light.
Sorry, Chair, in fact, it is dealing with the internal audit consortium. But the thing that you just put in context, when you go out to tender, you put out a tender preference. And when a tender responds to the tender preference, that in itself, and you accept the tender, that in itself constitutes a contract. Okay, talking about that, we design an SLA and all of this so that we can tighten up the process. However, this was not done, this was a managed process, because the internal audit committee themselves were aware of this. What had happened was that this one clause decided to add to the contract, and that was saying, if something happens because of the actions of the consortium, we'd like them to pay, I think, twice the cost of what it cost the department. And that wasn't agreeable to them. However, the rest of the terms of reference they were delivering on in the meantime, because we needed to get the internal audit function up and running. But this was done in a managed fashion. Even the internal audit committee would constitute external people, independent external people who are fully aware of this. Of the process.
I would then move back to the aspect of the procurement, the preferential procurement policy, but as such as that, with the particular tender that has been allocated wrongly or falsely, because I think this is a gross overstatement, but it seems to me that additional points had been allocated to this particular tender by the tender committee without any basis, without any foundation of whatever nature, in addition to the 10 points that they were allowed to give. And it is stated in that particular section that between 3 and up to 20 points has been added additionally. Now, I would first like to inquire, how is it possible that additional points, in addition to what is the prescription, could have been added? Then I want to know, is that still the same tender committee that is with this? And the person who benefited from this, is this also a person that has been related to any of the staff members or the internal structure over there? Have we done here, was there corruption involved with this? Or what was the position really in terms of this artificial adding of points to a system that was not supposed to have been done?
No. Obviously, I would agree with the Honourable Member. This is the mere letter of consent, for which we have taken the corrective action by introducing a report of legal in the process as the tender office certificate to ensure that the calculations are correct. So this is the problem. I would not say on the face of it whether there was corruption or not. In fact, I don't even know whether we know who was the actual contractor in this case. But the committee, no, it's not the same committee. We changed the committee. We changed the committee from time to time. I think we change the committee every year. I appoint a new committee and the committee every year to present people getting used, I think, to the function, because otherwise some structures tend to happen.
So yeah,
no, this is not happening anymore. We've corrected that. Okay, because of the irregularity, which was corrected, but I don't know if the people would like to do
that. I'm probably talking under correction, but generally what happens now, up front, in the terms of reference, and I think it was also done during that period, in the terms of reference, the point scoring is in fact advertised up front. So it's not after the event, somebody goes and says, I want to add 10 points or 15 points to this particular criteria. So all the tenders are aware of what those points are, but unfortunately those scoring were not in terms of the triple GSA at the time.
What's the right to general agree with me that 2 million in terms of this was waste through expenditure and which has been practically stolen from the taxpayer?
Yes, I mean, if it's true that the tender price of the self-rated consultant was 2 million less than a successful consultant, then I would agree with you. It is an irregularity that has amounted into that.
But then lastly, did the person who should have had the tender took any action against Trade and Industry? Because he should have been, in my mind, he should have been fully entitled to sue the department for this money and for this particular contract in terms of the his fundamental common law rights.
No, to my knowledge, there's been no consequences to this matter. I suppose because the report is a public document, but because it's such a long time ago, this may be something that is more kind of appreciated.
In closing, I can then just say that the department is an extremely lucky organization, because this should have reached some stages of absolute maladministration, and I think gross incompetence, or if it's not gross incompetence, tender committee, then gross irregularities from the tender committee. I think more should be done in terms of this to rectify this in the future.
Rukul, has your concern been covered? Except for the discrepancy on the definition of a consultant or consultancy. I think that's the point of it, why the discrepancy, or that is what was then, is still the case in terms of what you put in place. But let me hear from you. Are you covered, or are there points you still want to take up?
Chairperson, I'm not that I'm aware of. I don't think I'm covered.
You don't think you're covered?
No. That's why I'm down to understand my way.
No. I said that when Honorable Stevens and Honorable Baker asked their questions, maybe some of your concerns will be covered. So now they are done. That's why I'm coming back to you. That if they are not covered, then we can then go back to your concerns. Yes.
Could I have a speech?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, Chairperson, I was saying, you know, during the questioning, the DG said there are no guidelines for appointment of consultants. If I asked him well, that's what he said. Well, I'm not very sure what he meant for the department. But if he meant for the department, I think there was a... This has to do with the... What I was saying was to do with the document that is the policy strategy to guide the reformity in procurement reform process in government. So I and when I look at the definition of what they say, their consultant is or what it would do. It's not the same, you know, in principle, or it doesn't give me the same sense as it does in this document. Because if I've got to repeat, if you allow me to repeat, consultants are engaged principally for the following reasons: to provide specialized services for limited periods without obligation of permanent employment. Contrary to that, on the report of the audit, I say, the DTI indicated in an internal report issued in July 2005 that for the past number of years, extensive use has been made of consultants by the DTI to perform specialized functions for which skills and capacity do not exist within the DTI. Now, there are definitions there. What I'm running short is the question of appointing consultants for limited periods and for transfer of skills. And I refer to the question that you had just asked, Chairperson, when it says here the accounting officer for AOPP did not specifically require the transfer of skills from consultants in the staff. Now, I just want to get the sense of why they appoint consultants and at the same time they do not necessarily want them to transfer the skills, which of course seems to be the same with our definition of what the consultant should do, contrary to what the policy is.
Alright. Fine, let's not allow the department to
No.
I should be asking you to ask questions and not asking them to respond to your question. I,
I want to say that the issues that I have quoted and that you are quoting refer to the situation that the DG had examined. And the critical question is subsequent to this report, which highlights this inconsistency that she has identified. What is it that the department has done to finish? So I don't want to respond to that, but let's allow the DG to respond. And if there's any shortfall, you would be free to follow up on that.
Different definition. I saw that the director for the tender committee, tender office, seems to have something to say about that. So I'm letting you do that. But let me deal with some of the substantive issues that have been raised. When I refer to the guidelines, it was related to a commission that was made to have guidelines for consultants. Now, we don't have a separate document that speaks of guidelines. These have been built in, as I said, they have been built in into our procurement procedures, which procedures are consistent with treasury rules and applicable legislation. So there are no issues really in the sense of whether our procedures fall short of what is the standard required, including for the use of consultants as such. Now I might add that yes, we do use consultants on a limited basis. Yes, we are now ensuring that when this transfer is required by the transfer happens, that all included in the contract and the service level agreement that we were talking to earlier on. So all of the concerns that we have in relation to procedures, standards, are all being addressed in relation to the current dispensation that we have in the department. So there are no issues there anymore. On a different the definition of consultants, I'm not aware of any differences. I think that I'm not aware of the document that you're talking about. So I know that the DPSA does from time to time also issue guidelines such as on the power and the rate and so on. But I'm not sure of, I'm not aware of the document in relation to which our definition differs. But Tion, isn't you understand?
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to provide more clarity regarding the definition. The definition, as mentioned in the finding, in the report from the IG's office, and as mentioned by the Honourable Member, is an extract from the Accounting Officer's Procurement Procedures. That document was compiled and approved by the previous Director General in October 2001. The other document, the guide that you refer to, was issued in 2004. That new definition is included in the amended supply chain management policy, and it's also incorporated in other departmental policies and circulars that was issued as far back as August 2005. So just provide clarity regarding the different interpretations of the definition. Thank you, Chair.
All right. So you are now in line with the definition that the regular set to. If the fitness on the site, then we'll don't forget.
Cost to the department because of the poor management or whatever the case might be.
I agree that this is an irregularity, that's clear. I agree it is an irregularity, but as you see, this is an irregularity that has to do with the way the tender was called. I don't know who was in the committee. I don't know who scored in a particular way. We haven't done that investigation, and as I have, it was a committee that is not in existence, as it was. Now, of course, we can go and do that, and go and look at, do another forensic, and look at who was in the committee, what was the actual problem with the scoring, and the details of all of this, to be able to arrive at the I don't know if you can help us in relation to when a particular tender is scored by a committee in a particular way, who takes responsibility. But to that, they're attributed to a particular individual or even a committee as well. So there are further issues in relation to this finding that we didn't look at. Our concern was to look at putting in place controls that would prevent such a thing from happening. That's it, right? So that was our focus. But to the extent that this is a matter of
I think what we have said, I don't think you're asking for a further correction. I think the basis we have said is that if you did a preliminary investigation, and it was easily identifiable that the individual X, Y, and Z is certain to the past, then you have to do it. I mean, good money after bad money, if you did a investigation. But I think if you want to send a message, then it's not okay to do something wrong and say, well, all was before my time. Because before your time, you see that it was not before my time, as a public citizen or anybody else's time. We can't go with that. But I'm saying, you then need to take that responsibility. I think that's the difference. You can't come here and say, that message was sent to DGI and it will continue to be sent to all the parties. We're not going to do something like that. So it's fine. I don't think it's doing any further work. But if it is easily identified, I'm suggesting that we do something about it. But don't go and explain to us how you're going to send it.
All right. We're done with the performance audit report. Yes, go back here.
So, you know, I just want to ask a question if I may.
Sure.
On page 8 of this report, deals with basically what happens with the declaration of interest, conflict of interest. Now, if you look at I, the first bullet, it says that an official from the tender office must attend all tender evaluations as an observer. It's a bit confusing to me, because one would like to know what is in the role of the tender office if they're not doing tender evaluations. But be that as it may, I'd like to know the capacity of that office and how big it is, and what are we talking about. And then if you look at the fourth bullet, it says here, this official must ensure that panel members declare any conflict of interest in writing and will keep record for all the purposes. Now, what does this mean? Say, for instance, this official is in this meeting and a panel member says, look, I have an interest in what company via my uncle or whether via my sister or whatever. What is this
specifically say, what must this person then tell this panel member? Must this panel member now leave the meeting? Or must this panel member sit there and not say a word and use body language like it is? What does it say? Is it specifically to this? Because I find this to be a grey area, and I think it's very weak. Because there's no use saying to someone that you must excuse yourself from the meeting. The fact that you have a conflict of interest, you shouldn't even have been in the process. Never mind just being absent from that specific meeting. Do you have a definite detail of what happens in these cases?
My understanding is that the tender office is the custodian of the rules and procedures that are required to be followed in relation to all tenders, from the publication of tenders, putting together the tender documentation and so on, and then ultimately in the evaluation to ensure that the evaluation takes place and to advise when necessary. But the CFO would like to
I think in response to the question, I think you referred to that probably that particular process is not strong enough. Let me just say that you have to have the documentation for persons to declare their interest. If you don't, then you've got no proof later on to say that you in fact asked this question and the person didn't declare their interest. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if anybody has an interest, but here you have to accuse yourself from the evaluation process, and another person gets appointed in the place. With respect to the tender office, I think the DG is right, the custodian of all of the policies and procedures, they're not technically competent in terms of the deliverables. So there are people that are technically competent in terms of the deliverables, but in terms of the procedure and the processes, they provide input to ensure that all of that is in fact complied with in the evaluation committee. With respect to the tender office, at the moment there are two individuals in the tender office, but we intend seeking, in fact, the submission that has been approved to beef up the tender office to double that number, because for two things. Firstly, the tender limit has been reduced by National Treasury from 500,000 to 200,000. That increases the number of tenders, so obviously the workload increases, and you need additional people. And obviously to provide the department with necessary support to be able to ensure that steps in the process are complied with.
All right, thank you very much. As well as UCG, earlier on that we would also want to take advantage of this opportunity to engage in the update on CIPO. I do know that since our last encounter, the fellow on CIPO agreed that we need to be given a quarterly update or regular update. And since then, indeed, we have had regular updates from the department on the progress that is being made. Maybe what we need will be a 5-minute input on what is it that has been done. I see I just got a report now that is an update that we should a bit longish. We hardly have that kind of time here for updates. But we have a very short, less than 5 minutes brief on what progress has thus far been made. And what can we expect in the report that is supposed to be coming after next week?
Maybe open up for questions after.
Yes, indeed. I'm going to open it up for questions afterwards, because I wasn't sure. I haven't read the report that is just coming, and I felt that maybe let them give us an update, and that could also assist members in terms of when to make follow-up. Are we fine with that? Give us an update, and then we will have questions if there are any. But if it is so clear that it is not happening, we'll just clap our hands and search for large folks.
Alright.
Yeah, let's get that short piece and then we'll take it up from
there. Thank you, Chair. Many honorable members.
Maybe you can have a mic, because just this as well.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair, Honourable Members, DG and other members of the Department. I want to just, in 5 minutes, just give you the highlights of the report, and probably should open a question on it. Give me the report on CIPRA, the Auditor General for the 2005-2006 case, CIPRA, the lowest possible grade, named the disclaimer. The Auditor General is unable to express an opinion on the financial statements due to the weak internal control environment, which resulted in policies and procedures either being non-existent or not strictly followed or explicit. On my appointment in August 2006, my management team and I introduced a general strategy to ensure that sound financial management principles are introduced and proper financial control is managed in CIPRA. A vigorous management intervention program was put in place to achieve this objective, and the result of these management interventions are that for the 2006-2007 financial year, CIPRA has received an unqualified report from the Auditor General. I'd like to repeat.
Please, by all means, do repeat.
So, I think there's a lot of effort put in terms of appointment of a few management cadre in the department, but also for a new CFO who arrived in January 2007. So there was a lot of work put into this. And the interaction with the Auditor General, in terms of getting an unqualified report, is not easy. So this is something we are very proud of. We're not ashamed of that. The second point that I want to mention is the special investigation into the procurement process that the Auditor General had looked into in 2005 and 2006. We subsequently asked PwC to do a further investigation with express objective to dig further into the issues and produce relevant charge sheets. We have taken disciplinary actions against 3 members that have still come management of CIPRA, and they've been charged and have been given final written warnings for a period of 6 months. The remaining 6 officials that have been implicated, we've asked via the DG's office, and it's in the process of being actioned. Some of those officials are working in other government departments, and some officials have left government service, and hence we want to also interact with the NPA to take this matter further. Other management actions, CIPRA introduced the following additional management actions, and I think it's necessary that I go through them in case there are questions and I might be answered. The supply chain management policy and procedure memo has been developed and is in the process of being implemented. The relevant supply chain management committees have been established and are working quite well. A comprehensive analysis of revenue was conducted, and this was important because in terms of the unqualified audit report. And all things income received was reconciled with general ledger. This was one of the issues that was raised in the previous audit report. A number of internal audits have been undertaken to identify possible control gains and to develop relevant management action. A proper set of procurement delegations have been developed and strictly enforced as from the 8th of December 2006, which was approved by the Director General of the DTI, the accounting officer. A control checklist has been developed and implemented to ensure compliance with the SCM policy. All IT-related goods and services are procured via CIPRA. terms of the regulatory orders for the 2005 and 2006 connection, a number of issues were raised. In terms of the internal control environment, a seven of the nine vacant positions in CIPRO's finance and procurement division have been filled, including the position of, as I mentioned previously, the PFO. Various senior management positions have been exercised and are in the process of being filled. Performance agreements for all senior CIPRO staff in 2005, for all management staff in CIPRO, is in place. A staff retention policy has been developed and implemented. An inventory count and asset verification was completed at the end of March 2007, and the reconciliation between general ledger and asset rate is done on a monthly basis. The internal audit and audit committee's functional and meeting on a quarterly basis is outsourced. Policies and procedures. Financial policies from GCI were adopted and were adapted to CIPRO requirements and have been implemented from January 2007. A supply chain management precision manual is now developed and implemented. Strategic plan and budgeting. The strategic framework as well as the business plan for 2007-8 has been finalized and submitted to the portfolio committee trade and industry. All financial activities and transactions are managed according to the approved 2007-8 budget as from 1st March 2007. In terms of the audit for 2005-2006, another issue was raised, a matter of the information systems audit. And a number of issues were raised, and I'll just go through a few of them. A standardized and controlled development environment has been established, and a change control process is now implemented based on best practice. The current IT system has been stabilized, and all technology is in the process of being replaced. A formal solution testing and system quality assurance environment has been established, and information security has been upgraded. ICT governance policy has been finalized. We have also submitted to the AG's department in terms of information audit a comprehensive audit plan, which they have studied. But in terms of a verbal comment to myself, they feel happy with the action to be taken, but I'm waiting for the written plan that you got. And also, in terms of our commitment to the scope, we are mandated to give quarterly reports. The next one is due August 2007. And I think a lot of the stuff in more details will be in that report. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. Comments from other members? Any questions? Please, on. Yes, Honourable Chair. Chair, was there any effect of two little words that worried me a little bit? You said your supply chain committee is working quite well. All the rest of your report has been pretty definite, and I was just worried as to why that was only quite well and not very well.
I apologize for my modesty. But I think it is working very well. But I'd like my CFO to comment on it, because it's quite closely involved in it.
Thank you very much. Now, the supply chain committee is working according to what's described by the National Treasury. We've made sure that there's a proper division of roles and responsibilities, and specific delegations were given to each and every member of the first committee. We follow the procedure.
Thank you. From current status to avoid this qualification. Another question?
Bottom line, my question is just how long does it take now if I inform you of a change in my construction of my company, the directors? How long does it take to be on the website and available? 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, 6 weeks?
Whilst we are still in the process of the terminal strategy, there's still quite a few operational issues that are involved in. We have implemented a quality management system that will be operational by the 1st of January 2007. It will be ISO 9000 accredited, and that's one of the projects that we're running. Even with those, some of the issues we have in the processes, for citizens, it still takes about a week, still a long time, and for companies, it takes about 3 weeks. In terms of our processes. Our vision in the next 8 months, and this is the vision that we have at CIPRO, is that we want to do the process in terms of CC on a 24-hour basis, and the companies on a 48-hour basis. And that's what we are endeavoring now in terms of all our project plans in terms of process and systems.
All right. Thank you, Colbert System.
In terms of the forensics audit report, I think we couldn't write any better about what has transpired. But I'd like to categorically say that no one, it's not put short that it's Klappenberg. These are high ranking, previously acting CEOs and directors. And in fact, all the people that we're pursuing now at that level. We've also followed a very independent process to get this thing done. In terms of the qualifications, I'll ask Renee to respond to that. But from my point of view, I think our supply chain management committees are running quite well, and I use the word quite well, so I'm comfortable with that. And the people that serve on that are usually executive team members and fiscal management team members. And the issues pertaining to IP and registration of companies. And people from both divisions have to attend those meetings. But we need to further expand on that.
Chairperson, thank you. The various committees that we've established, we've made sure that the relevant qualifications are verified and that the relevant people are there. For example, the relations committee is chaired by the supply chain manager, who is trained in the financial environment, so he's not a secretary or junior official, he's a senior official. And we also have a permanent legal advisor on that committee to make sure it complies to legislation. As the chair indicated, in terms of the bid adjudication committee, because of the problems that CIPCO encountered in the previous financial year, that the chairperson role, I've accepted that responsibility myself until the organization is stabilized. And the bid adjudication committee then consists of the senior executives, who together with myself and the CEO make a recommendation, and the CEO signs off the final recommendation from the adjudication committee.
I didn't have you been just a long time in this
conversation.
Okay.
Honourable Chair? Yes, I would like to concur with Vincent and to say that had I heard your input earlier, I might have had a slightly different question, answer to my question here that was filled in this morning about whether SCOTA has an effect on government. Clearly, as this is, should have an effect on that fact. But I just want to ask a question in slightly different. I think that you've made each progress, and the Auditor General's report will tell us shortly. In terms of your, the management of the compliance issues, etc. Okay? But that only is part of the story. The other part of the story hinges a little bit on the question of my colleague, Mr. Becker. And that is the product that you deliver. And my understanding is that, you know, you're a very important cog in that wheel, which makes South Africa a desirable place to do business. And I don't want to go through the whole range of things, you know, that you people do, but just to say, are you confident that your registration times, the quality and the accuracy of the information that you're producing, etc. Are you satisfied that we are making substantial progress in that regard? Now, I don't want to go into a whole debate about this, but I think it's one of the things that we'd also like to hear from you about when you give us those reports. So we can see how your product is also improving. What your, I suppose you're going to see that in your strategic plans when you produce them, but it would be nice to see here. Are you happy that that side of the coin is also getting a lot of attention?
Yeah, I would. No. I want Congress Peer to ask his question and close it, because the annual report is coming up the next week. I'm marking my days on the calendar. So we'll engage with those sort of questions much more fully than now, otherwise we'll find ourselves. Congress Peer?
Yeah, I hate to be the one to spoil this super picnic, but you know, I just came this morning to draw this information on the CIPCO website that was dated 22nd August. Now, this person has got a couple of CCs.
Now, there are some of the species who are not, if you put a certain name into the system, it kicks up the species that they own. But there are some of the species that are not there. But those species that are not there, if you put that species in, then the person's name comes up. So somewhere the system is still not properly functioning. And it could lead to a very embarrassing situation like we had about a year ago. So I want to bring it to your attention. I can provide you in detail for that, but I don't want to call it fixing, but your system is still not 100%. Thank you.
What is it called, the fixing? But, yeah, I think, look, what we wanted to get from CIPRO is a program support in relation to where we were in the last year. And I think some of those substantive issues we will deal with them when we deal with the annual report. I don't want to preempt any substantive engagement on anything. And I think people would not be expecting the process sorted out all its problems from where it was. If you look where they were and then where they are, there's reason to be happy about progress made. But saying that there's still distance to be covered. And I think what Comrade Pierre is raising is a specific issue that reminds you that there's still work to be done. The fact that you got an unqualified audit, it's no reason. Do a little jig of celebration, but just for a few seconds and get down to work, because there's still work to be done. I think that is the essence. But there's something that the Honourable Chen said. Maybe you want to respond to that. Before we call it
clear. Yeah, I think
Oh, after the question.
Give them an opportunity just to tell us. My question is simply, are they making progress in that field?
Okay.
Or happy with the progress?
I think your response in terms of the agreement second jig and then getting to work is very apt. And knowing where we were and where we need to go, there's a lot of work to be done. A lot of work. And when I submitted our action plan to the DG, the Expo, his comment was this is very ambitious. And so some of the things we have to downgrade for this. For the following year, because simply don't have the extra resources on board to do those things. But I wouldn't want to comment on that specific issue until I know what the exact problems are. Whilst we do find problems at times with the system, from our perspective, it's running soundly. There's nothing that we are panicking about. We know this problem in terms of response and the number of issues. So I don't create that comment, but I'd like to get the details and then interact with the honourable members. But Chair, I think my report will tell us exactly where we want to take the business. And one of the major issues on the table currently from a management team is basically one, stabilizing the business, decentralizing our services, and getting our processes and our systems to a level where we feel we are almost on par with world class, but that will take some time. And for ourselves, it's really getting down to brass tacks in the next couple of months. I think we've laid the foundation. One of the things we have to now obviously do is also in terms of skills level is upgrade that. And that, you see the step change coming as soon as we've done that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think that I think it's quite correct that in a specific issue that has been raised, that we know the program, but the challenges of CIPRO far exceed what we came here for. And there's still, as the CEO says, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. But there's also progress. I mean,
they're waiting on the backlog, they're looking at turnaround times, and all of them are gradually coming down. So we're very encouraged to be, but we're by no means over the challenges. This is an institution which suffers the population that is going to for a long time. It will take some time to get there. But what we need is an environment where there's confidence that allows us to actually do the work. You know, it's very difficult to do work in an environment where it's very unfriendly and can be very demoralizing indeed. So I think what the feedback we're getting is encouraging, and we should build on that to be able to take a challenge going forward. I just say that I'm happy. I can tell people that I'm not going to go to jail, because people are, every time they see me, when are you going to jail? The time comes to have a TV.
No, we see you. I think that's fine. We certainly also want to be in progress. Whenever department shall come for us, we want the interaction to assist in getting people to move forward. We have had honorable trend here on talking about making examples to ensure that everybody moves forward. We know the ambush of Chairman Mao, he wants fighting 1,000. We certainly don't want to fight in anybody, but we want in a positive manner. As we always say, want to work ourselves out of the job and so get everybody to do their thing so well that Parliament asks why do we need to go back to Sunday? That's exactly what we're working towards. Unwillingly so. But that's what we. So thank you very much, and I want to thank National Treasury, the Auditor General's Office, the Deputy Auditor General, and also members for having read through the two sessions that we've had. The new reports are coming. We're looking forward to this interaction. Our position is that this time around we're going to have all departments, qualified or unqualified. So this is by no means our last encounter with you. Not necessarily because things will be bad, but on a much more friendly and pliable basis. Thank you very much. We'd like to bring this engagement to a close, but for members, let's say good. There are one or two things that we need to sort out before we